Ticket scalping, when do you recall that happening, going back to your grandfather, your father? Do you remember that?
No. No, I don't remember ticket scalping really occurring of any consequence until probably the late 70s, and it became a real problem. When we were in the convention center box office, the scalpers in those days were a lot different than they are today. We had two or three local scalpers, and he would go to the homeless people and give them $5 to stand in line. He and his two or three staff would walk the lines to make sure the people didn't leave. He would place them in line to buy tickets, and he would walk up to the window with them, give them the money while they were at the window. He would put the tickets away, he'd give them the $5. Then we decided to try a couple of other tricks, so to speak, to foil the scalpers, and we started wristbands. Not only did we have wristbands, we numbered the wristbands. We would say a show was going on sale on Friday, so we would make it known through the media that Wednesday at noon, we would start distributing wristbands. They would be numbered starting with 001 and go to whatever number we wanted to print on the wristbands. So whoever came first would get number one. Well, that didn't really help because we had a tremendous crowd problem. We had thousands showing up to get number one wristband. So then we started another procedure with the wristbands, where we handed the wristbands out starting at noon on Wednesday, but it was going to be a random drawing of who would be first in line. You could come Thursday afternoon and have just as good a chance of being the first purchaser of tickets as the person that was there at noon on Wednesday. It didn't matter at that particular time when you received the wristband. It was put on your wrist. It had a number on it. Then, immediately prior to the tickets going on sale, we had someone from the audience, or a lot of times we had radio people there. We'd let them draw out of a box number 1 to 2,500 or whatever. Whatever number was drawn, that was the first person in line. They were waiting, and then, you know, this person would go, and from that person on, then you started consecutive behind that person, and when number 2,000 was given out or in line, then they would start with number one. That was a pretty good system, and they still use that system today. I noticed at the BOK Center that they use that procedure that we used to use. The big problem with scalping now is that in computerized ticketing, there are all these secondary sellers that sell at exaggerated prices. They obtain tickets and are able to put them on sale for much more than the person would pay. If you paid $150 for a concert ticket, you'll find out that within a day of those going on sale, many seats are on sale for $2,000, $600.
How do they get those tickets?
Well, there are many theories on how they get tickets. The theories have gone all the way from the computerized ticketing company being in bed, so to speak, with these sellers, to the acts and management of the acts and sellers themselves. There are many times that the acts request X number of tickets to be sent to them to distribute on their own to fan clubs or business associates. So being it's their show, being under the direction of these people, the box office and the facility has no alternative but to send them those tickets. Where they go from there has never really been discovered, but a lot of times some tickets are returned to the box office, and that's why you'll see tickets opened up a couple of days ahead of a show, because they weren't used. I do know a story that Concerts West told me when Frank Sinatra did a concert in New England, that Frank actually took the tickets for the entire house and sold them, or his people did, to Frank's closest friends, his, quote, underground associates. And when the tickets went on sale, officially to the public, there were only like 100 tickets available. This was way back in the early 70s. The public went crazy, as they still do today, saying, this is not fair, this is not fair. And supposedly, Frank's remark was, or his people was, well, tell these folks just to go to hell. This is my show, and I'm taking care of my friends first.
You had to be one of the most popular guys in the state of Oklahoma. There you were in their 20s, in your 30s, and you were the daddy of tickets.
Well, I was glad that Southwestern Bell gave you the option of unlisted phone numbers. I will say that.
You had to be hounded.
I can remember going up to Grand Lake where I spent many years from 1947 on, whenever a big sale would go on, and I had the great staff, which I've always been blessed with, to handle things, and being on the Marine radio, finding out how the sale was going, because I didn't want to be anywhere in Tulsa, Oklahoma, because I had a lot of friends that used to call and say, "Dick, this is so-and-so. How have you been doing? I know exactly what's coming." So I go, "Hey, it's good to hear from you, Joe," or whoever it was. So we'll get some small talk out of the way for about 2 or 3 minutes. "I haven't seen you since college, high school, or since we went to this meeting. Well, it was good to talk with you, Joe." "Oh, wait a minute, Dick, while I've got you, by the way." And then there would come the zinger. It was tough. It became a problem dodging the people.
Carson Attractions was family. It had to be one of the last in the country, is it?
It probably was the last. In fact, we were very close with Ringling Brothers over the years, a very large organization. And one of the fellows, one of the event coordinators that used to put together the Ringling Act here, later left Kenton Feld and went with World Wrestling Federation. He called, and I can remember Mike said, "I cannot believe you're still in this business. You're the only one left doing this." So we did last a long time, and many, many years and a lot of memories.
When did it end?
Well, actually, what happened in 1966, 41 years later, I had an opportunity to sell Carson Attractions to the firm that owns the Tulsa Oilers. We had talked about it for probably a year before. They were hoping, because of connections, to end up with the ticket organization for the new BOK Center. It didn't work out. SMG, the management firm, decided to keep it in-house and open their own box office. They kept the business going for another year or so, and of course sold their own ice hockey tickets, as well as continued to sell other tickets for concert events. But it didn't work out. So at that particular point, Jeff Lund decided to go ahead and close.
Timing's everything, isn't it?
Well, it turned out to be. It turned out
because you had no idea.
A lot of years. No.
You didn't sell it because you saw that coming.
No. In fact, he had come to me because he had a very tight relationship with someone that was going to be able to pull some strings, but that didn't work out.
And again, when did you sell it?
2006, 41 years later, after coming on board.
Did you have any shows of Garth Brooks?
No, we never did. Garth always did his own shows. He was kind of like Elvis used to be years and years ago, where he sold his own. Now, if he does go back on tour, he's almost obligated to use the in-house box office, wherever the arena is that he plays. But what he used to do here in Tulsa was he'd go to Driller Stadium and actually put his own people there.
You talked much earlier about Caruso.
Mm-hmm.
There is the story of Caruso and his performance at the Brady. I see you smiling here.
There was one story where Caruso was blaming the Brady Theater, or actually Convention Hall, in those days for a draft that he caught and disrupted his voice and also caused his demise, I think. But I don't know how much credence there is to that story.
Okay. But that would have been a show that your grandfather...
That's correct. He presented all of that type of attractions. And those were the Elvises and the Garth Brooks and the Eagles. I mean, that was the big thing. You didn't have pop music in those days. The only music was fine art culture. That was what was presented, and they brought it out from New York and the East Coast.
What about Sinatra back there? Because he was singing in the 40s and 50s.
Right. I don't recall a Sinatra engagement. I do know that they had people like Fred Waring and the Pennsylvanian Choir. Guy Lombardo went out on tour. Harry James. They would present some of those at Convention Hall in those days.